switched to Sparkplug Coffee yet? Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and a rotating seasonal blend if you like to shake it up. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this splendid coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a Coffee of the Month club. It's completely personalized and flexible, and it comes with all kinds of member benefits. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey, all, and thanks for tuning into the second week of our fifth annual Oscars Month, where we talk about the Academy Awards and certainly delve very deep into past Best Picture winners, as we'll do today. You can hear all kinds of podcasts about dozens of other Best Picture winners in our archives, along with all the 123 films that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. Many of those 123 did, in fact, win the last trophy on Oscar night, like The Godfather, Godfather Part 2, Forrest Gump, Gone with the Wind, Casablanca, and many more. Those episodes had spoilers, so will this. I'm the fellow who killed his brother and then lied to cover it up, and now the guilt is ruining me. Ryan Ellis. What? And here's a lady who, unlike Mary Tyler Moore, sure does like to hug and is good at it. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
Now, just to explain my whole thing about the conspiracy there, killing his brother and covering it up, it was almost a nutshell. His big confession scene, which probably won Timothy Hutton the Oscar, when he tells his therapist that he actually killed his brother and it's just killing him that he has to pretend that he didn't. Jealousy. I'm only kidding, but that is going to be a theme in this podcast. Not so much jealousy, but family troubles, of course, that is the whole theme of this whole episode. So the coming attractions trivia for Ordinary People. Robert Redford was directing his first movie and infamously won the Best Director Oscar over Martin Scorsese and other people, of course, too. But Scorsese's the one that stands out the most because he was nominated for the first time ever that year. He didn't get nominated for Taxi Driver. How many of the other three guys up for Best Director that year were receiving a nom in that category for the first time?
Four of them were first-time nominations.
I never looked up to see if it's ever been that all five people were new in that category, but 4 to 5 is probably pretty rare.
Yeah, the only repeat was Roman Polanski for Chinatown.
And only had that one nomination. He'd been nominated for writing a few times, or at least once anyway, but he'd never been nominated for...
It was just once for Rosemary's Baby.
Okay, now you look at it now. We talked about it in last week's Oscar show, Oscar's preview show, that Scorsese's got the second most Best Director nominations ever now. The most ever is William Wyler, so I don't know if he's going to catch him. He's nearly 80 himself, but... It's going to be hard for anyone else to ever catch him for second place. And I watched the Oscars speeches for Redford for Best Director, the Best Picture presentation for this movie, for Supporting Actor, and for the screenplay. And one thing stood out mostly, and that was the Best Director thing when Redford won. David Lynch and Richard Rush, I don't think we said this, by the way, are the other two nominees. Scorsese, Redford, those two, and then Polanski. Polanski wasn't there. He couldn't be there because of his whole thing where he fled after his rape conviction. Rush looks pissed. It wasn't like he was the front runner or anything like that.
Oh, yeah, and that was his last chance to ever get an Oscar, because, as I understand, after that, he never really made another... It was for The Stuntman?
The Stuntman. Yeah. Pretty solid movie, yeah. Peter O'Toole, weird movie,
that,
too.
And after that, I think the only award he won were Razzies, right?
Oh, I didn't look that up, but okay. And then Marty has a, well, that figures, look on his face.
Well, that's kind of what his face does. That's his resting face.
The funny thing is, though, that we mentioned Polanski. When Polanski won, the only time he's ever won... the Best Director Oscar was for The Pianist that was up against Gangs of New York, and Marty was one of the first ones to get up and give a standing ovation. Not that many people did because of Polanski's controversial story, his backstory and everything with what he's done in his life. But then he didn't look like he was annoyed. Point is that Marty almost had that, okay, fine, type look. I expected that anyway. But when they announced all the names, Marty got the biggest response from the crowd. It was one of those, yeah, responses more than the other guys.
He always seems to take it in stride, the award stuff. He has everything he could want as an artist, except maybe as much award accolades as he ought to have gotten.
He won a lot of Golden Globes over the years when he didn't win the Best Director Oscar. And Redford, though, not surprisingly, was very gracious and handled it very well, and even got pulled out by the producer, because that was back when it was, we've said this before, when the producer or producers went up to the stage, they might have had the director go with them. The guys that won for Rocky pulled Stallone up with them, even though he was just the writer and the actor. But rarely was anyone other than the producer or producers. And the producer, Ronald Schwery, actually literally said, Redford, come back out here, because Redford, I think, had just won for director. I'm not sure what the order was. Sometimes the director's way before Best Picture. And Redford comes back out, just says thank you. And he was very gracious. Anyway, big long thing there. We'll get into the whole point of this podcast, which is Ordinary People. And it is the Next 100 Project's 182nd episode, Regular Peeps, which was released by Paramount 40 years ago in September 1980. It only cost about $6 million, but raked in close to 10 times that amount. So obviously it was a pretty damn good success. But Bev, remind people what this 40-year-old movie is about with the skinny on Ordinary People.
Donald Sutherland and Mary Tyler Moore are Calvin and Beth Jarrett, a waspy upper-middle-class couple who are recovering from the accidental death of one teenage son and the failed suicide attempt of their other son, Timothy Hutton's Conrad. Together, the Jarretts have to muddle through this tragedy while coming to terms with each other's shortcomings and keeping up appearances with their peers. Their clashing priorities come into sharper focus with the help of Judd Hirsch's compassionate psychiatrist, Dr. Berger.
So, at the end of the movie, of course, spoiler here, but we already said we're going to do spoilers, Mary Tyler Moore leaves. So, in a nutshell, well, at least now the two guys can drink out of the milk carton and leave the toilet seat up.
The tyranny of the female rules is gone.
We'll also do the what happens next thing. I think with Calvin and Conrad, they maybe, but probably not, freeze to death in that backyard. It is December or January in Chicago. That's the area this movie is set, and they shot it, I think, in Chicago or that area as well. But it's definitely set in that time frame. It's around Christmas. And as for Beth, she goes on to become a golf pro and win many championships because she loved playing golf in Houston and even said, we should play more golf. She probably didn't do that anyway.
Well, she probably would have moved to Houston.
With her brother.
To get out of there because she would never accept the humiliation of her family falling apart. Plus, she probably would never want to see those two guys ever again.
Well, yeah, because when Donald Sutherland has this big scene at the end where he's crying, and understandably so, saying, I don't know if I love you anymore, I don't blame her for leaving, but at the same point, it was almost like she didn't need any motivation, or she needed that much, but she didn't need any more motivation to bail than for her husband to say, I don't want to be with you anymore. Okay, bye.
It's so striking how fast... He never says, you have to leave. He never kicks her out. It's kind of a surprise when then she just goes upstairs and starts packing a bag. And even though she's really visibly distressed, it's this inappropriate reaction. But of course, it's the reaction of somebody who is so tuned out from her feelings and so incapable of being vulnerable that she would rather abandon her family than open up.
Okay, so the Rotten Tomatoes numbers on this movie, 89% of critics liked it, 42 fresh, only 5 rotten, for an average of 7.9 out of 10, and 88% of audiences. It was 11th at the 1980 U.S. box office. Empire Strikes Back was number 1. The Shining, which we covered long ago, was number 14, and Raging Bull, which we already talked about, was number 27. Won the 4 Oscars, Best Picture, of course, Best Director for Redford, Supporting Actor for Hutton, and the adapted screenplay by Alvin Sargent, who won an Oscar, I think, before this as well. And then it was nominated for Best Actress for Mary Tyler Moore and for Supporting Actor Judd Hirsch. But no Donald Sutherland, the only one of the major cast who wasn't nominated. I think he should have been. I think it's the best thing he ever did, or if not the best, one of the top 2 or 3.
It still makes lists of people's greatest Oscar snubs of all time.
And the 5 some of Best Actors are all good. De Niro won for Raging Bull. You can't argue with that. That was an obvious choice, much like this year. Let's see, that would have been yesterday. We assume it'll be Joaquin Phoenix. We record this before the Oscars come out, but it's probably going to be him. And if it is, just like De Niro and Raging Bull, how do you argue with that? But at least Sutherland would have got his only ever Oscar nomination if he'd been up for this movie, and he probably should have been. And you knock out Jack Lemmon in Tribute. I don't remember ever seeing Tribute. No one was ever talking about it then that I recall. They don't talk about it anymore. And he'd been nominated and had won many times. So anyway, that would have been nice to see Sutherland get in there. And then you have the entire major cast. The only one you wouldn't really include, if you want to call her major, would be Elizabeth McGovern as Janine. This is also the rare Best Picture winner without any technical nominations. So no editing, cinematography, music, any of that stuff. Annie Hall a few years earlier did the same thing, where it had only above-the-line nominations. And in both cases, the movies won most of the nominations they actually did have. And, of course, Ordinary People was also nominated for the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists and didn't make it. But that's not surprising because everything that ever won an Oscar for Best Picture, apart from the English films, was at least up for those lists. I think they want to pay tribute to the Oscars with the AFI. You look at some of those like Broadway Melody and whoever talks about that movie, but it was nominated for at least the first list. All right, so here we go. A movie that certainly is up your alley. I think you said you liked it. You may have even suggested we do it anyway. What do you think of Ordinary People?
I love a good domestic drama. You're right. This is right up my alley. But it is one of those genres that's really easy to do poorly because you need to strike that balance between behavior that is authentic and relatable and behavior that is cinematically interesting. And Ordinary People is like the platonic ideal of that sweet spot. It made me think a lot of Terms of Endearment. Terms of Endearment is a movie that is more interesting, I think, than authentic. Because the performances are just a little bit over the top. I don't feel like the same emotional connection with that film. It doesn't dig quite as deep as Ordinary People does. But Ordinary People never bores me. That's like the risk right there. You're either phony or you're boring. But this is neither.
Terms of Endearment, of course, has a big scene. I'm going to do it right now. Hang on. I'm going to blow the microphone out. Give my daughter the shot!
That right there. Exactly.
Although in that context, as I recall, you can understand why she's that upset.
But that movie always makes a choice towards something that's more dramatically theatrical than something that is how people would really behave. What true grief looks like is not somebody yelling and thrashing about and outrageously behaving the way that she does. The way the drama plays out in this film, it just feels so real. Turns me inside out, some of these scenes. And maybe it's because I also grew up WASPy, not rich like this family was, but certainly middle class WASPy upbringing, where my parents never fought. They never had a single fight.
Mine did.
They had one fight and their marriage ended that day. I'm sure they had fights or something that I never saw, but they never outwardly expressed their anger or dissatisfaction with one another until it all happened at once. It was just like a volcano erupting out of the blue. You thought it was dormant, you thought everything was fine, and then the whole family blew up. So maybe that's another reason why I find this movie super duper relatable. Also, relatable because Conrad, I have not struggled the same things he has, but I have struggled with, like I've talked about on the show before, pretty bad garden variety chronic depression, and I have also spent a lot of time in therapy, so I think I relate to all that stuff. And this is a pretty good, close to accurate portrayal of what it's actually like to see a shrink.
My original nutshell was going to be, the main character's in therapy? No wonder Hollywood loves this movie. Or loved, you know, it at the time.
I was reading about this, that at the time, apparently psychiatrists loved this movie because most portrayals of the psychiatric professions.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Or something where it's like a total joke. You have Sigmund Freud stand in, somebody who's like a total gag to them, or someone who's evil and manipulative. Whereas this was a great portrayal of a professional who is compassionate and cares about his work and cares about helping people like a true medical professional would.
So the year before this Best Picture winner, another movie we've covered is Kramer vs. Kramer. And you mentioned Terms of Endearment, American Beauty, many years later, which we covered as well, and Moonlight, I think, in some ways, we covered that one, too. All one Best Picture, all small pictures about broken families. And maybe that's one reason why they won the awards that night, because Kramer vs. Kramer was up against Apocalypse Now. I would have given to Apocalypse Now, but that's also in retrospect. I was only five when that movie, when those movies came out. I hadn't seen either of them at that
picturing
point.
Picturing five-year-old you in your short pants. You got robbed, Apocalypse!
I'm an Apocalypse guy! But then Terms up against, well, maybe Terms of Endearment, which was a huge hit, would have been the right choice in 83. American Beauty versus some damn good movies in 1999. I'm not sure anything else necessarily should have won over that one. But then Moonlight, of course, La La Land, that big controversy. And then we get back to the movie we're talking about here, Ordinary People. Clearly Raging Bull is the one that most people would have said in retrospect should have won because it's almost always on things like the Sight and Sound poll. Well, it is on the Sight and Sound poll as one of the top ranked films. So maybe they made, in retrospect, not the wrong choices with Kramer versus Kramer and Ordinary People, but then as much as war movies can be, Apocalypse Now is not really real, is it? That's part of the reason why it works. We know about war films, and we know about a boxer and a self-destructive person, but these intimate kinds of movies where, especially in Ordinary People, Kramer versus Kramer to some degree, maybe not so much in Terms of Endearment, and American Beauty actually has got some pretty hammy performances in it. Moonlight, though, is pretty real. But what happens in Ordinary People is, what I was hearing about somebody saying recently again, is that what real people do is try not to cry.
Yes.
And Hollywood, and TV too for that matter, television shows, love to show people crying. Well, Sutherland does have a crying scene later on, and I think Hutton cries in his big breakthrough scene, but not the rest of the movie. Even though they're both broken people, and in a different way, so is Beth. But Beth's not a crier, so I wouldn't expect it from her so much.
She
but
does that's cry what at the end when she's packing her suitcase.
Okay, that one moment, yeah. Okay, well then there you go. They all have, I guess, one crying scene. But this is a movie where they could be crying all the time. I love also another good movie about grief, which is Moonlight Mile. Mm. which is a comedy as much as anything else. There's some definite sorrow in that movie. And again, movies that make it work where they don't have people constantly expressing their feelings because they don't know how to, because they don't know how to deal with it. Even grown-up people, even middle-aged people like Sutherland and Moore in this, don't know how to deal with grief. Beth clearly doesn't know how to deal with grief, and that's why this family does break apart. But then you gotta ask questions like, was Beth always, if not tough on Conrad, tougher on Conrad than Buck? Now, one thing I noticed is that their names, I don't think it's supposed to be his real name, but we'll just use his nickname, Buck, being a B, and C. Well, B comes before C in the alphabet. I think Buck always came before Conrad, which is not the end of the world. You can have a favored son or daughter and not have it be the other person is made to feel lesser than. But I wonder if that was always the case, and Conrad didn't notice or care. When we see the flashback scenes with Buck being charismatic, Conrad's not moping. He's laughing.
He loves Buck, too.
Right, but maybe there's a part of that you could argue that he still felt like, okay, I'm being overlooked as the second son, not the favorite son, but I don't really care so much. It's fine. But then when Buck is gone and his mother really pulls back, that's when he starts to notice it even more. Plus, he tried to kill himself, which is not really anything to do with her. It's the way he feels. And they show his wrists, man. He really did try to kill himself. If you want to try to kill yourself, you don't slice across your wrist. You slice down.
There's like a little throwaway line when the paramedics in a flashback are putting him in the ambulance and they say, oh, he cut down. He really meant it. He was really trying to die. Did Beth grow more distant because Conrad tried to kill himself? Is she afraid of fostering the attachment with him to protect herself from feeling that grief again that she felt when she lost Bucky?
She can't do it again.
It's a strength of the film that it's not really obvious whether Beth is incapable of loving Conrad or simply so afraid of her own emotions to respond to his. The fact remains that she makes no space for him. His messiness is nothing but a threat to her, but whatever motivates her aloofness, it is cruel. The audience is very much on Conrad's side, but Mary Tyler Moore really delivers such a complexity to Beth. She's in so much pain that she's shut down. She's not evil. She's, as you say, broken.
Yeah, she's always distant with all of them, but especially with Conrad. She's more close with Calvin, her husband, than she is with her own son. But she's also stilted with him. That's almost more noticeable than being distant or unhappy or what have you. But there's a really important scene, too, when a phone rings, and she's been talking to Conrad, being stilted. The phone rings, and then she comes alive with that person at the other end. Oh, how's it going? Whoever that was. And, of course, you do that. Back in the day when you answered phones, in some ways, it was a bit of a performance where you're doing the whole, hi, Bob, what's up with you? How are you? But she really does that, and considering how unhappy she was seconds before, doesn't make her a bad person. But you got to wonder why she's been that way, and she can't be that way with her son. I also wonder, can Beth just not handle failure? Does she view Conrad as a quitter for trying to kill himself? Maybe she's like that with Calvin, too. He's got a good job. If Calvin somehow lost his job, separate of all the things that happened with her sons, if he just got laid off or quit or whatever, and was like an American Beauty, just laying at home and has some shit-ass job like in a fast food joint, in some ways that character, the Annette Bening character, can't deal with failure, too. But is that maybe Beth's issue as well? We have this great upper-middle-class life. Nothing can ever ruin that, which seems to be pretty obvious as part of her character. But also, nobody can quit. Nobody can ruin that, especially not the four of us. My oldest son, who I worshipped, isn't here anymore. And I was joking before about how it was an actual murder and a cover-up, which I don't believe. I was only joking about that. But maybe there's a part of this hard-to-reach woman that feels like her worshipped son gave up on life and didn't hang on because that line towards the end where Hutton tells Hirsch, he let go, I hung on.
And Hirsch says, well, maybe you were stronger. You were just the stronger son. No matter what Buck portrayed, his appearances were always that he was stronger, but the fact is Conrad was the one who was strong enough to hang on and fight for his life. Robert Redford said that Beth, when he read the book, she was a character that he cared the most about. She's a villain. She is cruel and she doesn't deserve her fate because
I don't think villain's
Mary,
fair.
Yeah, Mary Tyler Moore plays her so well. I find it such a relief and it's a catharsis at the end that Calvin and Conrad are going to be on their own. They're going to be without her. Conrad has had this catharsis in therapy. They're just going to look after each other now, and you're so happy for them, but you don't hate her. And that was part of how Redford pitched it to Mary Tyler Moore. This was really playing against type for her. She said that she was thrilled to do something different, and she based this character a little bit on her father. Even though she gives it a really authentic, feminine way of coping with this stiltedness, I think it's actually a perfect word for it, it feels radical that this film is about a family where it's the mother who is the one who's difficult, who's the one that can't be reached, and ultimately cruel. Another thing that makes this film feel unique.
A lot of movies would have ended with her being challenged by Calvin and then saying, I'm sorry, I should have been a better wife and especially mother all along. I'll do better next time, rather than going upstairs. And yes, she breaks down a little bit, but still packs a bag and says, okay, if you don't want to be with me anymore, bye. I'm not saying she's a villain. I disputed you a minute ago, and when you did say that, I wouldn't use that word for it, because she can't handle the pain of this. We've talked about this in our podcast as the years have gone on, and you've explained more about the depression you've experienced, and some people have written to us and really appreciate that. The thing we've also learned in the last several years about Me Too and just being more accepting of people in general, not demonizing someone because they have mental issues or seem to have mental issues, which I do find ironic, even though I do it too, the way people do that about the president, because if we're supposed to be more sympathetic, then where's their sympathy for him? He maybe belongs in an asylum. But anyway, the point being, that's, I think, what's going on with her, and we can't judge her when we aren't in her shoes. And even if you were in her shoes, you still, you can always judge somebody, I guess. But it's not fair to just write her off. And I always remember the line Larry King said about the nurse in Cuckoo's Nest. Nurse Ratched, you hate it, huh? And maybe you do hate Nurse Ratched, although there's some scenes in that movie where you could argue that you shouldn't hate her. But Beth is a great example of a character that if you do hate her, you're not watching the movie very closely.
Yeah.
And Redford connected, you said, with the Beth character, but also just the book in general, because I guess, like most families, his talked around the issues. They didn't get to the whole point a bit. And at least Conrad's finally doing that in therapy. Calvin goes to therapy. A lot of other movies would have had Beth go to therapy separately, or they all go together. That's mentioned. Calvin says that the doctor says they should all go, and she's not going to. You know she's not going to. Maybe she'd be more apt to go by herself, but she's sure not going to go with the other two men present as well.
And it is equally refreshing and strange to watch the men in this film act their vulnerability and be the ones to come through for each other, almost to overcome the negative influence of this cold mother. And I think watching men come to terms with difficult emotions, it's in a way more moving, because we subconsciously understand how much harder it is for men to do that when they have so few examples to call upon, and there's just so many punishments for men who are vulnerable, who are human. And apparently, Redford speculated anyway that the character of Beth is part of the reason why he had a hard time getting a studio to make it. He had to go to many studios before he got somebody to agree to make it, and they all said that they just didn't like that the lead woman was so dark and negative. So it's not just that it's refreshing and strange for us to watch this. Part of it is that Hollywood just doesn't want to make movies like this. If it was about a bad dad, any studio would have made it. I feel like I've seen that movie 100 times.
The Great Santini that same year was about a bad dad. And that was up for some nominations, including an opponent for Hutton and Hirsch, supporting actor Michael O'Keefe or something like that, was up for that one. And Robert Duvall plays a tough dad. I think Duvall is one of the nominees up against De Niro, and he should have been up against Sutherland for Best Actor. So yeah, the exact same year. That's fine, we'll make that movie. And it's not like Duvall was a headlining star. Good actor, was in a lot of great movies in the 70s. But that movie probably was a lot easier to get made than this one was for the reasons you just said. And this is 40 years ago. I don't think that much has changed.
No, I absolutely agree. This movie still feels radical. And it's cathartic to watch men access their emotions and have this kind of emotional journey. No studio is ever going to say no to a movie about a woman overcoming an abusive situation in any way, not necessarily characterizing this as abusive, but an unhappy family, a woman overcoming that. That is a movie that gets made over and over again. Those are books that get written. Those are TV show plots that get written into season after season. It is so refreshing to see it from the perspective of a man.
And Sutherland is also going a little bit against type. I think he could have just as easily played the doctor as Gene Hackman, apparently, was up for the role.
They wanted him to play the doctor. He was brought into audition for the doctor. It was his idea. No, I really want to play the dad. And I can't remember, there was something about it that he related to, or I think he also said that the character of Beth reminded him of his own father or his own family situation, and he just felt like he understood it really well, and so he asked Redford if he could read for Calvin, and he did, and he got the part.
Isn't Sutherland himself supposed to be a bad dad?
I've heard some rumors through the grapevine of people who know people, because they're Canadian, right? That, yeah, he wasn't the greatest dad.
With Kiefer.
But he's an actor, so he could act like a good dad.
With Kiefer and the daughter as well, Kiefer's sister. What's her name?
Rachel.
Okay. It's also interesting that Robert Redford would direct this as his first movie, or any movie, because he wasn't the most open actor ever, and certainly at this point in his career, he'd been in so many good movies, but he wasn't the kind of actor that was revealing of his feelings. I remember Nicholson was supposed to be always someone who couldn't cry, didn't want to cry on screen, but did in some movies like Five Easy Pieces, which we might cover this year. It's the 50th anniversary of that film. Redford was an actor who I think was more closed off in that kind of way than Nicholson was, or other actors you might say that about. And here he's directing a movie where they're closed off, but they're going to find an epiphany. So I like that too, in a way. It's almost like, what are you doing directing this movie? Maybe that's one of the reasons why the other directors reacted the way they did about this movie. This guy directed this film, you give him an Oscar for it? That's not his movie. Well, anyway, you know what I'm saying.
It's an actor's movie. The thing that makes this movie work is the performances and the screenplay, right? So I can see how it would appeal to an actor, because that's the key to making the film great, is getting great performances out of people. And by all accounts, he was kind of like the horse whisperer on set, that he had this comforting authority that everybody responded to and everybody trusted him.
Redford only directed 9 movies, and I say in the past tense because he's probably not going to direct anything else again. He's supposed to be retired from acting. I bet we'll see him again before he's fully done. But he hasn't directed anything since 2012, and we're looking at it in almost 10 years now. He didn't make another movie after this as a director until 1988 with The Milagro Beanfield War. And apart from Ordinary People, I think his best movie is Quiz Show. He usually works with big stars in these movies, though, apart from maybe Milagro. River Runs Through It was a young Brad Pitt. Horse Whispers himself. Legend of Bagger Vance is Matt Damon and Will Smith. Lions for Lambs is Tom Cruise and Meryl Streep. So he ends up working with big stars a lot of the time. But he didn't really have a directing career that took off from that. Just like Costner, who also beat out Scorsese for a movie that he could easily have won an Oscar for. And his first movie, with Dances with Wolves, it's not like Costner went on to make movie after movie as a director, and was only a couple that he ever made in total.
Well, as people often point out, most of the Academy voters aren't critics. They're actors.
Right, they're the biggest branch, and that's why acting movies like Ordinary People, Terms of Endearment, American Beauty, Moonlight, those kinds of actor showcases.
The Raging Bull was certainly an actor showcase, too, so...
True, but more of a technical kind of movie, I guess, and maybe it was off-putting to people, and maybe it was also a matter of, yeah, but Marty, you're still young, you'll get there again. And he did get there as a nominee many more times, but didn't win until 26 years after Raging Bull. Now, if you haven't watched this movie in a while, and you might watch it after hearing us talk about it, don't worry if you hear silent opening credits, because we thought maybe something was wrong with our speaker, or I had the mute button on and didn't know it. I tried everything. We realized, no, the credits are just silent. So like Annie Hall, I mentioned that a while ago, that also has silent credits, and then you start the film. But the next thing we see after the credits is Conrad singing in the choir, and he's singing some Hallelujah song, which is obviously has religious overtones. Not that this movie's really religious, exactly. We also are starting to realize he has survivor's guilt, but we don't know why yet. That's really parceled out later on until we finally see what really happened. You see snippets of it until you finally see Buck and Conrad in the water, and Buck doesn't make it out. Why would a great swimmer drown? Yes, Berger, the therapist, says, maybe you were stronger. But I don't know if that's all that well directed to show that Buck is maybe hurt. If he was bleeding, I might say that he passed out or something like that. But it's just, hang on, Conrad. I will, Buck. You hang on, too. And then Buck just drops. But he's a champion swimmer. We see trophies all over the place.
The flashbacks are the biggest weakness of this film. It's about the only thing that I could criticize about the film is the flashbacks are not only overkill, I don't think we really need them as much as Redford thinks we do, but also not really well executed. And that scene in particular of the boat capsizing and the two boys hanging on for dear life, it's just poorly executed. The actor playing Buck does a very bad job of fake drowning.
Maybe Scott Dobler, who never acted again, never acted again for a reason.
It's just possible that it was a bad performance. I think it's what Hirsch says, is what Dr. Berger says. He got tired. There was no energy left in him. There was no drive, no fight left in him.
Well, he seems to be talking just fine, and then suddenly he's done. Now, we mentioned A Wild at Heart a few weeks ago with Sherilyn Fenn's death scene, where she's stunned, and she's obviously got some kind of head trauma, and she's bleeding, but she's talking normally, and then just lays down and dies. Now, she probably had a concussion. She surely was, well, clearly, was very seriously hurt. That's actually better executed in a scene I didn't really feel like needed to be in that movie at all, in Wild at Heart, than this is. And that was also Lynch well into his career, 15 or so years into his directing career. If I didn't say that already, he was the 5th nominee this year with The Elephant Man, another interesting, weird movie. Now, back to the family. Calvin, so Sutherland's character, was probably always the fun, charismatic one of the couple, and maybe of the whole family. Well, I guess Buck of the whole family, but of the couple. Not that she's not charismatic and fun in her own way when they do hang around people, but he's trying hard now, including the party scene when they go out with their friends and Cal talks about therapy with one of their friends. He says at least 3 times when they're sitting on the staircase about Conrad, he's great. He's great.
Mm.
He's clearly compensating. He's trying so hard. And I don't criticize him for that. Beth is not like that at all, though. When she sees that, she doesn't want her family to be exposed. She doesn't want it to be discussed.
I guess she wants to pretend it's not happening, too.
That's part of it, yeah. But I just get the feeling that Calvin, for whatever his faults are as a person, he wants his family to be so great, but he's not doing what I think happens in The Great Santini this same year, which is I'll whip you into shape. I forget if he's actually physically abusive to his kids in that film. But I'm sure that it's at least some kind of abusiveness going on there. Whereas Calvin is always seeming to be a pretty great dad. The few scenes we see with Buck. Do you really see any scenes with Buck and Calvin actually interacting? At one point, Calvin says to Conrad towards the end of the film, well, maybe the last scene they have together outside, when he says something about how he never had to worry about Conrad, but Buck needed to be whipped into shape, and you said something just like you. That really touched me when you said that, by the way.
Really?
Well, my mother said something like that to me a couple of years ago. Not quite the same way, but same kind of idea. It may not be untrue, but it's just nice to hear somebody say that.
Yeah, sometimes the neglected child is just the one who was
Because you don't need to be babysat the same kind of way. Especially when you get to be a little bit older. The two boys are still young, and we're talking about me being my mid to late 40s now, but it's nice to know that, especially when you're the youngest kid, as Conrad is, just as I am, you're the one they worry about the least. It is a compliment and meant that way for sure. We see Conrad interacting with Karen and, of course, obviously with Jeannie later on. Jeannie, I guess they call her Jeannie. It says Jeannie here in the credits, but I think they call her Jeannie all the time. Jeannie and Conrad, it's the love interest characters in this film, Hutton and McGovern. But Jeannie and Conrad are the aunt and uncle for Tarantino's character in Pulp Fiction.
That's right.
My Uncle Conrad and Aunt Jeannie give us these blankets and they're not with us anymore. Maybe he's an Ordinary People fan. But anyway, when Conrad's meeting up with Karen, who he met from the psychiatric hospital, and talking about what happens with her now, she seems like she's up, and so is he. He's never more happier and freer. Well, maybe when he gets to know Jeannie a little bit later on, he's a little happy and free. But that, I think, goes to show with Karen that she must be doomed. If he's going to be happy and free, then she's not going to make it. And
so she's like, let's have a great Christmas.
And then she kills herself, and that's what leads him to have his, not really a breakdown, but he basically has to talk to Berger. Had Berger not been available, it might have been a bad scene. Not that it's on him at all, if Conrad decided to try to kill himself, but because he can talk to Berger, and Berger talks him through it, and you get the similarity to Good Will Hunting. And apparently, Damon and Affleck were influenced by this movie.
Oh, no kidding.
Including the therapy scenes. Although, Robin Williams is way more personal than even Hirsch is in this as Berger. But in both movies, it does come down to hugging. Everybody's hugging! Which I guess is something that therapists just don't do. You know better than I do. But I remember people criticizing Good Will Hunting for that thing at the end. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. And then hugging him like that. I'm so sorry. I think it was maybe William Goldman who supposedly wrote that screenplay who said, I love that screenplay. I didn't write it. And one of the reasons why I could prove I didn't is no therapist has ever done that in the history of the world.
I take a few issues with some of the boundary crossing that I've never personally witnessed. Even worse than the hugging is Dr. Berger insisting that he's Conrad's friend. That's crossing a line that therapists are not supposed to cross. And like most films that portray therapy, this one certainly exaggerates the, quote, breakthrough moment for dramatic purposes. But I feel like it earns it. Okay, well, you need to do something to make this more interesting. Therapy sessions are probably super duper boring to anybody who's not personally invested in that patient getting better. So I forgive it for some of the leaps that it takes. And especially once I learned just how far this came from how most movies portrayed therapy, psychiatry, psychology, the fact that this is a film that closer to accurately portrayed what it's like to go into therapy.
Now when Calvin meets with Berger himself in his individual meeting, that's when he starts to realize, I think, the movie at least says, that it is hard to be married to Beth. He probably knew it, but now he really knows it, and it's not by any means Berger's fault by talking to Calvin that it leads to them probably getting divorced. But Calvin being able to actually express that is, I think, the chain reaction.
And I love the line that he has. It's supposed to be that he wants to talk about Conrad, and he wants to talk about his progress, and then in the end he goes, maybe I came here because I just need to talk about myself. Because he went through a thing too, you know, this family went through a massive tragedy, and they're working overtime to try and pretend that nothing's wrong, and it's absolutely exhausting, and it's also not working.
And Sutherland even says to Moore at one point about how, you criticized me for wearing the wrong colored shirt, we were going to bury our son, who cares what I wore? You should try to dress a certain way at a funeral, I guess, but he's right, it doesn't really matter in the end. And it's one of those things where I'm glad they didn't show too much of the funeral. They don't think they showed all the funeral, do they?
No, they don't.
That's probably smart. Don't do a flashback. But talking about clothes, one thing I really noticed in this viewing is that Beth and Calvin are always wearing formal clothes when they're just sitting around at home. Now, that might be an old-fashioned touch. Old movies that we've watched and reviewed many times over, men are wearing three-piece suits in houses all the time and just hanging around. They maybe really did do that back in the 30s and 40s, at least more commonly than they ever would now. But this movie is supposed to be set the year it came out, around 1980. But it just seems striking to me that they're wearing these kinds of clothes. Maybe it's one of those things you want the characters to look this certain way, but I think it's supposed to be saying that they're this perfect cut off from real people kind of thing, regardless of their son dying, they would have been like this anyway.
And it's no accident that the film, the book, portrays the Jarretts as a well above average and probably on the cusp of being in the 1% of Americans income-wise. There's the aspect of their appearances, that they're just going to care more about things, as you say, so much so that they'll be dressed formally even when they're at home, and there's that stiffness associated with that. But also, they have everything they need. On the surface, they have a perfect life with no worries. But all those trappings are helpless to protect them from tragedy. It doesn't matter that you can get on a plane to anywhere you want anytime you feel like it, spend Christmas in London. So Dickensian, like she says, that won't bring your son back. Money doesn't insulate you against tragedy. Beth is convinced that she can recover from tragedy by just polishing the veneer that is their perfect little middle-class life.
Which is something that happens in American Beauty, too, with the Annette Bening character, where she seems like she wants to, before things really go to hell, just simply put a Band-Aid on this problem they have. The most important scene in that whole movie, at least between those two characters, is when they start making out on the couch, and he's about to maybe spill a beer on this couch. And we said that, I think, in that podcast. That she's not wrong. He can put the beer down. It would take 2 seconds.
It's Italian silk!
If you're turned on, you'll stay turned on. But his whole point is, this doesn't matter. Us connecting is what matters. So I'm with him in a way, but I'm with her in a way, too, in that one scene. But that is the critical moment in that whole movie. If they had connected then, maybe they would have been okay after all. But they didn't. This is the same kind of deal, I guess. Well, the big fight that they have, and they really only fight one time with Calvin and Beth when they're in Houston with her brother and his wife. They fight when they're on the golf course. Uncomfortable for the brother and the sister-in-law to watch that. And they fly home with it clearly unresolved because nothing is resolved with these two and probably never will be. Until Sutherland gets his big scene where he confesses he doesn't love his wife. But even that isn't really a resolution. It's more a matter of, here's what I'm really feeling. This is the big issue of our marriage. Beyond our sons, beyond tragedy, beyond anything else. I don't think I can love somebody who's like you. And then she runs away, understandably. The movie, in a way, is unresolved, though, if you think about it. It's clear that they're not going to be a couple anymore. She just bails. But they don't actually finalize it, which I think is a tribute to it, that even when they're talking, they're still not talking. Maybe Calvin and Conrad will now. Maybe they'll both go to see Berger and they'll be better off. They probably will. But Calvin wears his heart in his sleeve, and he's had his heart broken, but maybe he realized that he was always with somebody where it was a little bit too hard.
He's always in the middle between Beth and Conrad, and he's always trying to walk that line, and then Beth thinks that he's always taking Conrad's side, and Conrad thinks that he's always taking Beth's side. But when it becomes really evidently clear to Calvin that he has to actually make a choice between his wife and his son, it's not a hard choice for him. It is the right thing to choose your son. In this family, under these circumstances, it's the right choice to make. And it's almost as if there's a part of him that's a little relieved to just say, let the anvil drop, let this family be destroyed, as long as I can just go ahead and help Conrad and try and save him without you interfering. And have this relationship with my son without you interfering. It's a beautiful moment. It's such a catharsis for the audience.
So Sutherland, who's 84 now and still working, has made 130-plus movies. We covered MASH long ago. It was on the AFI's list. The year before this, I think it was, or a couple years before this maybe, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the remake, which is weirder and in some ways more horrifying than the original movie. And then more recently, he was in the Hunger Games films. So his resume is extraordinary. He's worked for so long. The other movie he probably should have gotten nominated for would be Without Limits, supporting actor in that one, though. He's quite good in that.
I just thought of another performance of his that I absolutely love in a movie I adore, which is Six Degrees of Separation, which is another movie that ends with a marriage abruptly breaking up. Okay. In a sense that one of the people in the marriage go, oh my god, I've finally seen what a shallow, broken person you are. We are a terrible match, and they just get up and walk away.
Well, the mismatch for him in this movie, Mary Tyler Moore, was known, of course, for a show where she won, I think it was 3 Emmys, and she won Emmys for other things, too. And the Dick Van Dyke Show before that in the 60s or 50s or whatever that was with him. So she was clearly a TV star. She only ever made 16 movies. And I think after this, she didn't make one for a while. Maybe the idea was, well, I made this one, great performance, didn't win. Sometimes people get pissed off with Hollywood when they don't win an Oscar as well. Although she lost to Sissy Spacek, who was great in Coal Miner's Daughter, so pretty hard to argue with that. But this character, if you know her from those TV shows, especially the one that she had done for so many years in the 70s, was so unlike this character, so she's really going against the grain. And then Judd Hirsch was, we talk about TV, he was still on Taxi on TV. And
another
then
one playing very much against type.
Yeah, right, exactly, by playing this character, but it could have been Gene Hackman, that would have been interesting casting too. He's in another Best Picture winner, A Beautiful Mind, many years later, and then Jeff Goldblum's father in Independence Day. Maybe a lot of people know that one best for all of his work. And then Hutton making his debut, wins the Oscar. It was unusual for someone so young to win Oscars. It's more common now, the last 20 or 30 years, where some newbie or relatively new person on the scene will win one of the acting Oscars, usually supporting awards, although he really should be in the lead category.
Oh, he's the lead actor!
He's in the movie, I think, more than the other two. The only reason you could argue that it's more Sutherland and Moore's movie, because she probably should be a supporting actress, and then I guess Sutherland would be supporting, and then Hutton should have been maybe leading. But it could be that Paramount just positioned Hutton. They thought he would have a better chance because they knew he wouldn't beat De Niro. Who was going to beat De Niro that year? So you could go that route. Plus, he's the newbie. He was unknown, relatively unknown. His father actually died not long before this movie came out. He was in John Wayne movies. He was this big strapping guy. James Hutton, I believe, is his name. Who died not long before this movie came out. Jim and Tim. So he could take from that experience. I don't know if he did or not. That would be method actor kind of thing to do that. Mary Tyler Moore lost her son, I think, to suicide not long after this movie came out. Maybe that's why she didn't make a movie for a while. Actually, she lost her son. And apparently Hutton felt isolated on the set by the crew and by Moore. And I don't know if that was deliberate by Redford.
It was.
Okay, because they were making him be a method actor whether he wanted to be or not.
Yeah, Redford didn't tell him that he had told all the cast and crew to just leave Hutton alone and let him be lonely. Because he wanted him to feel isolated and lonely.
Kind of mean.
It's a little mean, but look, it won him an Oscar. Is he That's sad?
Well, and his speech is quite nice. He's very gracious and he definitely thanks Redford. And like, he overlooks him. Or just, I think the writer, Sergeant, just said my director. So I don't know, maybe there's something going on there. But Hutton never really took off after this movie, despite being friends with Sean Penn and I think maybe Tom Cruise when they did Taps. Apart from his good TV credits, he never really had a lot of great movie credits. Briefly, M. Emmett Walsh is in the film as the swim coach. And it is, of course, ironic that Conrad quits the swim team. Maybe not ironic, actually fitting that he can't be on a swim team when his brother died in the water.
Yeah, no
but kidding. Walsh is the swim coach. He was in Blade Runner. We covered that, of course, a couple years after this. And then his best role might be Blood Simple, where he's, in a way, the main character. And he had a very small role in Knives Out just a couple months ago, which is one of the best movies of 2019. And we said McGovern made her debut in this movie as well. She was in Ragtime the next year, and then I've never seen Downton Abbey, but apparently she's on that TV show. And then the movie that just came out not long ago, she was in that as well. She's the love interest in this movie. And one of the things about the book, which has been banned in a lot of schools, apparently that's because they have sex, which was taboo to a lot of people, and probably still is, teens having sex. Also the suicide and the bad language. So even though you don't think of this as a Catcher in the Rye, bannable kind of book, it's been banned. Judith Guest, who I think as well, Redford and certainly Sargent made mention of her when they won their Oscars. And then Adam Baldwin is one of the friends. He's in Full Metal Jacket, and we covered that a few years ago.
And he's Firefly is probably the thing he's most famous for.
Oh, true, yeah.
And then being an active member of Gamergate to
right,
just
yeah.
destroy any goodwill he ever
At first he seemed like he was a nice guy in this movie, but then it's portrayed that he's a bully. He didn't come across like a bully the first scene in the car with the four of them, the other three friends, so him, two other guys, and Hutton's character. But then as the movie plays out, he is a bit of a bully. I thought that was a little bit
like
weird.
That's like another mislead, too. You believe that the jocks are these dummies who are picking on him and he just doesn't fit in because he's a little bit above them. And then you learn at the end of the film that it's really that he just can't stand being around them because they remind him of Buck too much. And he has survivor's guilt, of course, but he also just misses his brother. Everybody loved Buck, but he really loved him and looked up to him, too. And so things that remind him of what's missing in his life, like the jocks, the swim team friends, I'm using quotation marks, that he can't tolerate to be around them.
It's too bad he killed his brother. Shouldn't have done it. So we talked about Redford already. His writer, Alvin Sargent, based this on Judith Guest's novel. Sargent won two Oscars and worked on three different Spider-Man scripts, including the one we talked about last year, Spider-Man 2 from 2004. And Ronald Schwery was the producer. He was involved with Tootsie and Scent of a Woman in the years that followed this. But I don't see anything else where he was the producer of too many movies. And it was just him. He went up on the stage and accepted the Oscar that night. And as I said, brought Redford out as if to say, hey, buddy, you just won an award, but come stand with me for a minute. Thank you very much. And then the show's over. We watched the 1.85:1 crappy DVD print. Mostly yeah. In the beginning where it looks so bad because they show some outside scenes of the lake it's supposed to be. And just a lot of dirt and shit on the print. It wasn't very good at all. The cinematographer, John Bailey, who was the Academy president until last August, for a couple years he had that job, he did The Big Chill as a cinematographer and then also Groundhog Day. Of course, we covered Groundhog Day a few years ago, and that exact day was only a week and a day ago. The editor, Jeff Canoe, also mentioned the Oscar speeches quite a few times, did seven other edit jobs, but then went on to directing, including Revenge of the Nerds.
Oh, wow.
The movie that has not aged all that well.
It sure hasn't.
And the music was adapted by Marvin Hamlisch. I believe it's taking classical music and then adapting.
Well, it's Pachelbel's canon. Prior to this film, Pachelbel's canon was obscure.
That it's obscure to me now.
It's not. I think it's replaced Here Comes a Bride for brides walking down the aisle. If I could play it for you now, you would immediately know it, and I mean every note of it. It's an incredibly popular and beautiful song.
Well, I think Kramer vs. Kramer did the same kind of thing, because it's got that classical music in the very beginning, the opening. That song plays the beginning of Kramer vs. Kramer, and I don't think there's a lot of other music in that movie, which I'm sure you appreciate. And there's not that much in this one either, so two straight years of tamped down music for the Best Picture winners. And Hamlisch would have known Redford from The Sting and The Way We Were, which were out the same year, 1973, and maybe that's why Redford used him in this, because he knew him from those pictures.
I thought of another reason why I probably love this movie. There's very little score in it.
Mm-hmm.
I started to notice that, and then I started to notice the scenes where they did put a little bit of score in, and almost every time I was like, dial it back, I don't need this.
What did you think of the look and the cutting then? I thought they were just fine.
Technically, it's just fine. It's typical high-quality Hollywood. There's nothing really that outstanding or remarkable about it. this movie's all about, the screenplay and the performances.
Contrast to Raging Bull, which was black and white, but otherwise was such a glossy, big kind of movie.
And with beautiful compositions.
I think The Stuntman, the same year as this, was also pretty cinematic. Elephant Man, despite being black and white, another one that was beautiful looking. I shouldn't say despite, probably because it was in black and white, but another beautiful movie. What a group that was. Lynch, Redford, Scorsese, Polanski, maybe not so much Richard Rush, but the other four guys are... Redford, not so much directing, but legends.
Redford's a legend in a way.
Not as a director.
More of an actor.
As an actor, definitely. But not so much as a director. All right, your last thoughts on a very solid movie and one that I think people may have forgotten about, that won Best Picture 40 years ago. I think in retrospect, it should have been Raging Bull. Can't really argue with this choice either. I would rather it be the other movie. It's a better movie. It's a greater movie. It's a more meaningful movie for the history of the business. But for what people are really about, what people go through in their lives, it's hard not to find something you can relate to in this movie.
I like Ordinary People better than Raging Bull. I can pay respect to Raging Bull, much like you do. I get that it's a very important film. Certainly a more challenging and gutsy film. But I just like Ordinary People better. I find it very moving and understated, and it doesn't make me miserable and angry the way Raging Bull does. And if it's been a while since I've seen this movie, absolutely revisit it if you have any good feelings about it. It is a really beautiful piece of art. Subtle, and certainly more domestic and simple, but beautiful nonetheless.
And because at this point the Academy voters were definitely predominantly men, I'm sure they could relate to the fact that this is the second straight Best Picture winner with a mother who just isn't there for her son. Because that was the same theme in Kramer vs. Kramer.
Oh, yeah, great point. Interesting.
They let us down. And that was also a theme in Cuckoo's Nest. The nurse is not their mother, but she might as well be, and she's really letting them down, too.
Oh, yeah. Women letting people down in the late 70s.
But at least in Kramer vs. Kramer and Ordinary People, you can't really call them villains, I don't think, the way you can the nurse in Cuckoo's Nest. All right, so in 7 days, we'll go back a mere 5 years to talk about the surprise winner of the 2015 Best Picture Oscar, Spotlight. And I played that like Morgan Freeman did. Read the card, held for a minute. Spotlight. The coming attraction is trivia for Spotlight. The 2010s was not the greatest decade for Best Picture winners. This is, by the way, going to be an opinion thing rather than actual trivia. You had The Artist, Argo, The Shape of Water, and Green Book. That's 4 of the 10 right there that we don't think are great. Maybe you like some of them, but would you put them on a top 5 list? Well, that's what I'm going to ask you to do, because from that decade, what is your top 5 of the 10 Best Picture winners? Starting with The King's Speech in 2010 and ending with one of the likely winners this year. It looks like it's going to be either 1917 or Parasite. Now, we'll know when we post this podcast, but we record it before the show. It seems like it's going to be one of those two. I know you like both those movies, especially Parasite. So do a top 5 for next week.
All right, so for our top fives from the 20-teens, tune in to...
Green Book will be number one for all of us.
Oh, yeah.
For both of us,
we
by
just,
the way.
Yeah, listen to our podcast
Artist,
about that. The Artist,
number 1.5.
Oh, yes.
No, wait, it's the reverse of that.
All five are just going to be The Artist, for sure. In the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where hundreds of episodes of the Top 100 Project are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made, plus many, many more titles on top of that. In exchange for all of this content, we love ratings and reviews. It helps people find us. We are both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code top100project. And that's all one word, top100project. It's not case sensitive, for a 20% discount. I'm not sure I love you anymore.
Okay, bye.
And cut.